never been much good at hiding my feelings. I know what you're thinking, she said after a pause. But I did try. I really tried. For months. And he just pushed me away. Her jaw was rigid, her expression oddly furious. He actually didn't want me here. He made that very clear. She seemed to be waiting for me to say something. It's really none of my business, I said eventually. We both stood facing each other. You know, you can only actually help someone who wants to be helped, she said. And then she was gone. I waited a few minutes, listening for the sound of their car disappearing down the drive, and then I went into the kitchen. I stood there and boiled the kettle, even though I didn't want a cup of tea. I flicked through a magazine that I'd already read. Finally, I went back into the corridor, and with a grunt, picked up the log basket and hauled it into the living room, bumping it slightly on the door before I entered so that Will would know I was coming. I was wondering if you wanted me to... I began. But there was nobody there. The room was empty. It was then that I heard the crash. I ran out into the corridor just in time to hear another, followed by the sound of shattering glass. It was coming from Will's bedroom. Oh, God, please don't let him have hurt himself. I panicked. Mrs. Trainor's warning drilled through my head. I had left him for more than 15 minutes. I ran down the corridor, slid to a halt in the doorway, and stood, both hands gripping the doorframe. Will was in the middle of the room, upright in his chair, a walking stick balanced across the armrests so that it jutted 18 inches to his left, a jousting stick. There was not a single photograph left on the long shelves. The expensive frames lay in pieces all over the floor, the carpet studded with glittering shards of glass. His lap was dusted with bits of glass and splintered wood frames. I took in the scene of destruction, feeling my heart rate slowly subside as I grasped that he was unhurt. Will was breathing hard, as if whatever he had done had cost him some effort. His chair turned, crunching slightly on the glass. His eyes met mine. They were infinitely weary. They dared me to offer him sympathy. I looked down at his lap, and then at the floor around him. I could just make out the picture of him and Alicia, her face now obscured by a bent silver frame among the other casualties. I swallowed, staring at it, and slowly lifted my eyes to his. Those few seconds were the longest I could remember. "Can that thing get a puncture?" I said, finally, nodding at his wheelchair. "Because I have no idea where I'd put the jack." His eyes widened. Just for a moment I thought I'd really blown it, but the faintest flicker of a smile passed across his face. "Look, don't move," I said. "I'll get the vacuum cleaner." I heard the walking stick drop to the floor. As I left the room, I thought I might have heard him say sorry. The King's Head was always busy on a Thursday evening, and in the corner of the rear bar area it was even busier. I sat squashed between Patrick and a man whose name appeared to be the Rutter, staring periodically at the horse brasses pinned to the oak beams above my head, and the photographs of the castle that punctuated the joists, and tried to look even vaguely interested in the talk around me, which seemed to revolve chiefly around body-fat ratios and carb loading. I had always thought the fortnightly meetings of the Halesbury Triathlon Terrors must be a publican's worst nightmare. I was the only one drinking alcohol, and my solitary packet of crisps sat crumpled and empty on the table. Everyone else sipped at mineral water or checked the sweetener ratios on their Diet Cokes. When finally they ordered food, there wouldn't be a salad that was allowed to brush a leaf against a full fat dressing, or a piece of chicken that still sported its skin. I often ordered chips just so that I could watch them all pretend they didn't want one. I couldn't say I enjoyed the triathlon terrors gatherings, but what with my increased hours and Patrick's training timetable, it was one of the few times I could be guaranteed to see him. He sat beside me, muscular thighs clad in shorts, despite the extreme cold outside. It was a badge of honour among the members of the club to wear as few clothes as possible. The men were wiry, brandishing obscure and expensive sports layers that boasted extra wicking properties, or lighter-than-air body weights. They were called scud, or trig, and flexed bits of body at one another, displaying injuries or alleged muscle growth. The girls wore no makeup and had the ruddy complexion of those who thought nothing of jogging for miles through icy conditions. They looked at me with faint distaste, or perhaps even incomprehension, no doubt weighing up my fat-to-muscle ratio and finding it wanting. "It was awful," I told Patrick, wondering whether I could order cheesecake without them all giving me the death stare. "His girlfriend and his best friend."
"You can't blame her," he said. "Are you really telling me you'd stick around if I was paralyzed from the neck down?"
"Of course I would."
"No, you wouldn't. And I wouldn't expect you to."
"Well, I would.
But I wouldn't want you there. I wouldn't want someone staying with me out of pity."
"Who says it would be pity? You'd still be the same person underneath."
"No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't be anything like the same person." He wrinkled his nose. "I wouldn't want to live, relying on other people for every little thing, having strangers wipe your ass. Jesus, think of all the things you couldn't do." He shook his head. "No more running, no more cycling." He looked at me as if it had just occurred to him. "No more sex."
"Of course you could have sex. It's just that the woman would have to get on top."
"We'd be doomed then."
"Funny.
Besides, if you're paralyzed from the neck down, I'm guessing the, equipment doesn't work as it should."
I thought of Alicia. "I did try," she said. "I really tried. For months."
"I'm sure it does with some people. Anyway, there must be a way around these things if you think imaginatively." "Huh." Patrick took a sip of his water. "You'll have to ask him tomorrow." "Look, you said he's horrible. Perhaps he was horrible before his accident. Perhaps that's the real reason she dumped him. Have you thought of that?"
"I don't know." I thought of the photograph. They looked like they were really happy together.
Then again, what did a photograph prove? I had a framed photograph at home where I was beaming at Patrick like he had just pulled me from a burning building, yet in reality I just called him an utter dick, and he had responded with a hearty, "Oh, piss off!" Patrick had lost interest. "Hey, Jim. Jim, did you take a look at that new lightweight bike? Any good?" I let him change the subject, thinking about what Alicia had said. I could well imagine Will pushing her away.
"But surely if you loved someone, it was your job to stick with him, to help him through the depression, in sickness and in health and all that."
I'd started to feel a little guilty about the way we were discussing my employer, especially when I realized that he probably endured it all the time. It was almost impossible not to speculate about the more intimate aspects of his life. Patrick nudged me. "I'm thinking about doing the big one."
"The big what?"
"Triathlon. The extreme Viking. 60 miles on a bike, 30 miles on foot, and a nice long swim in sub-zero Nordic seas. The Viking was spoken about with reverence. Those who had competed, bearing their injuries like veterans of some distant and particularly brutal war. He was almost smacking his lips with anticipation. I looked at my boyfriend and wondered if he was actually an alien. I thought briefly that I'd preferred him when he worked in telesales and couldn't pass a petrol station without stocking up on Mars bars. You're going to do it?
Why not? I've never been fitter.
I thought of all that extra training, the endless conversations about weight and distance, fitness and endurance. It was hard enough getting Patrick's attention these days at the best of times.
You could do it with me, he said,
although we both knew he didn't believe it. I'll leave you to it, I said.
Sure, go for it.
And I ordered the cheesecake. If I had thought the events of the previous day would create a thaw back at Granter House, I was wrong. I greeted Will with a broad smile and a cheery hello, and he didn't even bother to look around from the window.
Not a good day,
Nathan murmured as he shouldered his way into his coat. It was a filthy, low-cloud sort of a morning, where the rain spat meanly against the windows, and it was hard to imagine the sun coming out ever again. Even I felt glum on a day like this. It wasn't really a surprise that Will should be worse. I began to work my way through the morning's chores, telling myself all the while that it didn't matter. You didn't have to like your employer anyway, did you? Lots of people didn't. The photographs were stacked carefully in the bottom drawer, where I'd placed them the previous day. And now, crouched on the floor, I began laying them out and sorting through them, assessing which frames I might be able to fix. I'm quite good at fixing things. Besides, I thought it might be a useful way of killing time. I'd been doing this for about 10 minutes, when the discreet hum of the motorized wheelchair alerted me to Will's arrival. He sat there in the doorway, looking at me. There were dark shadows under his eyes. Sometimes, Nathan told me, he barely slept at all. I didn't want to think how it would feel, to lie trapped in a bed you couldn't get out of, with only dark thoughts to keep you company through the small hours. I thought I'd see if I could fix any of these frames, I said, holding one up. It was the picture of him bungee jumping. I tried to look cheerful. He needs someone upbeat, someone positive.
Why?
I blinked.
Well, I think some of these can be saved. I brought some wood glue with me, if you're happy for me to have a go at them. Or if you want to replace them, I can pop into town during my lunch break and see if I can find some more. Or we could both go if you fancied a trip out.
Who told you to start fixing them?
His stare was unflinching. Uh-oh, I thought. I was just trying to help.
You wanted to fix what I did yesterday.
Do you know what, Louisa? It would be nice, just for once, if someone paid attention to what I wanted. Me smashing those photographs was not an accident. It was not an attempt at radical interior design. It was because I actually don't want to look at them. I got to my feet.
I'm sorry. I didn't think that you thought you knew best. Everyone thinks they know what I need. Let's put the bloody photos back together. Give the poor invalid something to look at. I don't want to have those bloody pictures staring at me every time I'm stuck in my bed until someone comes and bloody well gets me out again. Okay? Do you think you can get your head around that?
I swallowed. I wasn't going to fix the one of Alicia. I'm not that stupid. I just thought that in a while you might feel...
Oh, Christ!
He turned away from me, his voice scathing.
Spare me the psychological therapy. Just go and read your bloody gossip magazines, or whatever it is you do when you're not making tea.
My cheeks were aflame. I watched him maneuver in the narrow hallway, and my voice emerged even before I knew what I was doing.
You don't have to behave like an ass.
The words rang out in the still air. The wheelchair stopped. There was a long pause, and then he reversed and turned slowly so that he was facing me, his hand on the little joystick.
What?
I faced him, my heart thumping.
Your friends got the shitty treatment. Fine. They probably deserved it. But I'm just here day after day trying to do the best job I can, so I would really appreciate it if you didn't make my life as unpleasant as you do everyone else's.
Will's eyes widened a little. There was a beat before he spoke again.
And what if I told you I didn't want you here?
I'm not employed by you. I'm employed by your mother. And unless she tells me she doesn't want me here anymore, I'm staying.
Not because I particularly care about you, or like this stupid job, or want to change your life one way or another, but because I need the money. Okay? I really need the money.
Will Traynor's expression hadn't outwardly changed much, but I thought I saw astonishment in there, as if he were unused to anyone disagreeing with him. Oh, hell, I thought, as the reality of what I'd just done began to sink in. I've really blown it this time. But Will just stared at me for a bit, and when I didn't look away, let out a small breath, as if about to say something unpleasant.
Fair enough, he said, and he turned the wheelchair around. Just put the photographs in the bottom drawer, will you? All of them.
And with a low hum, he was gone. Chapter 5. The thing about being catapulted into a whole new life,
or at least shoved up so hard against someone else's life that you might as well have your face pressed against their window,
is that it forces you to rethink your idea of who you are,
or how you might seem to other people. To my parents, I had in 4 short weeks become just a few degrees more interesting. I was now the conduit to a different world. My mother, in particular, asked me daily questions about Granter House and its domestic habits, in the manner of a zoologist forensically examining some strange new creature and its habitat. "Does Mrs. Traynor use linen napkins at every meal?" she would ask. Or, "Do you think they vacuum every day like we do?" Or, "What do they do with their potatoes?" She sent me off in the mornings with strict instructions to find out what brand of loo roll they used, or whether the sheets were a poly-cotton mix. It was a source of great disappointment to her that most of the time I couldn't actually remember. My mother was secretly convinced that posh people lived like pigs. Ever since I'd told her at age 6 of a well-spoken school friend whose mother wouldn't let us play in their front room because we'd disturb the dust. When I came home to report that, yes, the dog was definitely allowed to eat in the kitchen, or that, no, the Traynors didn't scrub their front step every day as my mother did, she would purse her lips, glance sideways at my father, and nod with quiet satisfaction, as if I just confirmed everything she'd suspected about the slovenly ways of the upper classes. Their dependence on my income, or perhaps the fact that they knew I didn't really like my job, meant that I also received a little more respect within the house. This didn't actually translate into much. In my dad's case, it meant that he'd stopped calling me lard-ass, and in my mother's, that there was usually a mug of tea waiting for me when I came home. To Patrick and to my sister, I was no different, still the butt of jokes, the recipient of hugs or kisses or sulks. I felt no different. I still looked the same, still dressed, according to Trina, like I'd had a wrestling match in a charity shop. I had no idea what most of the inhabitants of Granter House thought of me. Will was unreadable. To Nathan, I was, I suspected, just the latest in a long line of hired caregivers. He was friendly enough, but a bit detached. I got the feeling he wasn't convinced I was going to be there for long. Mr. Trainor nodded at me politely when we passed in the hall, occasionally asking me how the traffic was, or whether I'd settled in all right. I'm not sure he would have recognized me if he'd been introduced to me in another setting. But to Mrs. Trainor, oh Lord, to Mrs. Trainor, I was apparently the stupidest and most irresponsible person on the planet. It had started with the photo frames. Nothing in that house escaped Mrs. Trainor's notice, and I should have known that the smashing of the frames would qualify as a seismic event. She quizzed me as to exactly how long I had left Will alone, what had prompted it, how swiftly I had cleared up the mess. She didn't actually criticize me. She was too genteel even to raise her voice. But the way she blinked slowly at my responses, her little as I spoke, told me everything I needed to know. It came as no surprise when Nathan told me she was a magistrate. She thought it might be a good idea if I didn't leave Will for so long next time, no matter how awkward the situation. She thought perhaps the next time I dusted I could make sure things weren't so close to the edge that they might accidentally get knocked to the floor. She seemed to prefer to believe that it had been an accident. She made me feel like a first-class idiot, and consequently I became a first-class idiot around her. She always arrived just when I dropped something on the floor, or was struggling with the cooker dial, or she would be standing in the hallway looking mildly irritated as I stepped back in from collecting logs outside, as if I'd been gone much longer than I actually had. Weirdly, her attitude got to me more than Will's rudeness. A couple of times I'd even been tempted to ask her outright whether there was something wrong. "You said that you were hiring me for my attitude rather than my professional skills," I wanted to say. "Well, here I am, being cheery every ruddy day, being robust just as you wanted. So what's your problem?" But Camilla Trainor was not the kind of woman you could have said that to. And besides, I got the feeling nobody in that house ever said anything direct to anyone else. Lily, our last girl, had rather a clever habit of using that pan for two vegetables at once. Meant, you're making too much mess. Perhaps you'd like a cup of tea, Will. Actually meant, I have no idea what to say to you. I think I've got some paperwork that needs sorting out. Meant, you're being rude and I'm going to leave the room. All pronounced with that slightly pained expression and the slender fingers running up and down the chain with the crucifix. She was so held in, so restrained. She made my own mother look like Ozzy Osbourne. I smiled politely, pretended I hadn't noticed, and did the job I was paid to do. Or at least I tried. Why the hell are you trying to sneak carrots onto my fork? I glanced down at the plate. I'd been watching the female television presenter and wondering what my hair would look like dyed the same color. Huh? I didn't. You did. You mashed them up and tried to hide them in the gravy. I saw you. I blushed. He was right. I was sitting feeding Will while both of us vaguely watched the lunchtime news. The meal was roast beef with mashed potato. His mother had told me to put three sorts of vegetables on the plate, even though he had said quite clearly that he didn't want vegetables that day.
I don't think there was a meal that I was instructed to prepare that wasn't nutritionally balanced to within an inch of its life.
Why are you trying to sneak carrots into me?
I'm not.
So there are no carrots in that?
I gazed at the tiny pieces of orange.
Well, okay.
He was waiting, eyebrows raised.
I suppose I thought vegetables would be good for you?
It was part deference to Mrs. Traynor, part force of habit. I was so used to feeding Thomas, whose vegetables had to be mashed to a paste and hidden under mounds of potato, or secreted in bits of pasta. Every fragment we got past him felt like a little victory.
Let me get this straight. You think a teaspoon of carrot would improve my quality of life?
It was pretty stupid when he put it like that. But I'd learned it was important not to look cowed by anything Will said or did.
I take your point, I said evenly. I won't do it again.
And then, out of nowhere, Will Traynor laughed. It exploded out of him in a gasp, as if it were entirely unexpected.
For Christ's sake!
He shook his head.
I stared at him. What the hell else have you been sneaking into my food? You'll be telling me to open the tunnel so that Mr. Train can deliver some mushy Brussels sprouts to the Red Bloody Station next.
I considered this for a minute.
No, I said, straight-faced. I deal only with Mr. Fork. Mr. Fork does not look like a train.
Thomas had told me so very firmly some months previously.
Did my mother put you up to this?
No, look, Will, I'm sorry. I just wasn't thinking.
Like that's unusual.
All right, I'll take the bloody carrots off if they really upset you so much.
It's not the bloody carrots that upset me. It's having them sneaked into my food by a madwoman who addresses the cutlery as Mr. and Mrs. Fork.
It was a joke.
Look, let me take the carrots and...
He turned away from me.
I don't want anything else. Just do me a cup of tea.
He called out after me as I left the room.
And don't try and sneak a bloody zucchini into it.
Nathan walked in as I was finishing the dishes.
He's in a good mood,
he said, as I handed him a mug.
Is he?
I was eating my sandwiches in the kitchen. It was bitterly cold outside, and somehow the house hadn't felt quite as unfriendly lately.
He says you're trying to poison him. But he said it, you know, in a good way.
I felt weirdly pleased by this information.
Yes, well, I said, trying to hide it. Give me time.
He's talking a bit more, too. We've had weeks where he'd hardly say a thing, but he's definitely up for a bit of a chat the last few days.
I thought of Will telling me if I didn't stop bloody whistling, he'd be forced to run me over. I think your definition of chatty and mine are a bit different.
Well, we had a bit of a chat about the cricket. And I gotta tell you.
Nathan dropped his voice.
Mrs. T asked me a week or so back if I thought you were doing okay. I said I thought you were very professional. But I knew that wasn't what she meant. Then yesterday she came in and told me she'd heard you guys laughing.
I thought back to the previous evening. He was laughing at me, I said. Will had found it hilarious that I didn't know what pesto was. I had told him supper was the pasta and the green gravy.
Ah, she doesn't care about that. It's just been a long time since he laughed at anything.
It was true. Will and I seemed to have found an easier way of being around each other. It involved mainly him being rude to me, and me occasionally being rude back. He told me I did something badly, and I told him if it really mattered to him, then he could ask me nicely. He swore at me, or called me a pain in the backside, and I told him he should try being without this particular pain in the backside and see how far it got him. It was a bit forced, but it seemed to work for both of us. Sometimes it even seemed like a relief to him that there was someone prepared to be rude to him, to contradict him, or tell him he was being horrible. I got the feeling that everyone had tiptoed around him since his accident, apart from perhaps Nathan, who Will seemed to treat with an automatic respect, and who was probably impervious to any of his sharper comments anyway. Nathan was like an armored vehicle in human form.
You just make sure you're the butt of more of his jokes, okay?
I put my mug in the sink. I don't think that's going to be a problem. The other big change, apart from atmospheric conditions inside the house, was that Will didn't ask me to leave him alone quite as often, and a couple of afternoons had even asked me if I wanted to stay and watch a film with him. I hadn't minded too much when it was The Terminator, even though I have seen all the Terminator films. But when he showed me the French film with subtitles, I took a quick look at the cover and said I thought I'd probably give it a miss.
Why?
I shrugged. I don't like films with subtitles.
That's like saying you don't like films with actors in them. Don't be ridiculous. What is it you don't like? The fact that you're required to read something as well as watch something?
I just don't really like foreign films.
Everything after Local Bloody Hero has been a foreign film. Do you think Hollywood is a suburb of Birmingham?
Funny. He couldn't believe it when I admitted I'd never actually watched a film with subtitles. But my parents tended to stake ownership of the remote control in the evenings, and Patrick would be about as likely to watch a foreign film as he would be to suggest we take night classes in crochet. The multiplex in our nearest town showed only the latest shoot-em-ups or romantic comedies, and was so infested with catcalling kids in hoodies that most people around the town rarely bothered.
You have to watch this film, Louisa. In fact, I order you to watch this film.
Will moved his chair back and nodded toward the armchair.
There. You sit there. Don't move until it's over.
Never watched a foreign film, for Christ's sake, he muttered. It was an old film, about a hunchback who inherits a house in the French countryside, and Will said it was based on a famous book, but I can't say I'd ever heard of it. I spent the first 20 minutes feeling a bit fidgety, irritated by the subtitles, and wondering if Will was going to get grouchy if I told him I needed the loo. And then something happened. I stopped thinking about how hard it was listening and reading at the same time, forgot Will's pill timetable, and whether Mrs. Traynor would think I was slacking, and I started to get anxious about the poor man and his family, who were being tricked by unscrupulous neighbours. By the time Hunchback Man died, I was sobbing silently, snot running into my sleeve.
So, Will said, appearing at my side. He glanced at me slyly. You didn't enjoy that at all.
I looked up, and found to my surprise that it was dark outside.
You're going to gloat now, aren't you? I muttered, reaching for the box of tissues. A bit. I'm just amazed that you can have reached the ripe old age of... What was it?
26.
26, and never have watched a film with subtitles.
He watched me mop my eyes. I glanced down at the tissue and realized I had no mascara left.
I hadn't realized it was compulsory, I grumbled.
Okay.
So what do you do with yourself, Louisa Clark, if you don't watch films?
I balled my tissue in my fist.
You want to know what I do when I'm not here? You were the one who wanted us to get to know each other. So come on, tell me about yourself.
He had this way of talking where you could never quite be sure that he wasn't mocking you. I was waiting for the payoff.
Why?
I said. Why do you want to know all of a sudden?
Oh, for Christ's sake, it's hardly a state secret, your social life, is it?
He'd begun to look irritated. I don't know, I said. I go for a drink at the pub. I watch a bit of telly. I go and watch my boyfriend when he does his running. Nothing unusual.
You watch your boyfriend running?
Yes.
But you don't run yourself?
No, I'm not really... I glanced down at my chest. Built for it.
That made him smile. And what else?
What do you mean, what else?
Hobbies? Travelling? Places you like to go?
He was beginning to sound like my old careers teacher. I tried to think. I don't really have any hobbies. I read a bit. I like clothes.
Handy, he said dryly.
You asked. I'm not really a hobby person. My voice had become strangely defensive. I don't do much, okay? I work and then I go home.
Where do you live?
On the other side of the castle, Renfrew Road.
He looked blank.
Of course he did. There was little human traffic between the two sides of the castle. It's off the dual carriageway, near the McDonald's.
He nodded, although I wasn't sure he really knew where I was talking about.
Holidays? I've been to Spain with Patrick, my boyfriend, I added. When I was a kid, we only really went to Dorset, or Tenby. My aunt lives in Tenby.
And what do you want?
What do I want what?
From your life.
I blinked. That's a bit deep, isn't it?
Only generally. I'm not asking you to psychoanalyze yourself. I'm just asking, what do you want? Get married? Pop out some ankle biters? Dream career? Travel the world?
There was a long pause. I think I knew my answer would disappoint him even before I said the words aloud. I don't know. I've never really thought about it. On Friday, we went to the hospital. I'm glad I hadn't known about Will's appointment before I arrived that morning, as I would have lain awake all night fretting about having to drive him there. I can drive, yes, but I say I can drive in the same way that I say I can speak French. Yes, I took the relevant exam and passed, but I haven't used that particular skill more than once a year since I did so. The thought of loading Will and his chair into the adapted minivan and carting him safely to and from the next town filled me with utter terror. For weeks I'd wished that my working day involved some escape from that house. Now I would have done anything just to stay indoors. I located his hospital card among the folders of stuff to do with his health, great fat binders divided into transport, insurance, living with disability, and appointments. I grabbed the card and checked that it had today's date. A little bit of me was hoping that Will had been wrong. Is your mother coming?
No, she doesn't come to my appointments.
I couldn't hide my surprise. I'd thought she would want to oversee every aspect of his treatment.
She used to, Will said. Now we have an agreement.
Is Nathan coming? I was kneeling in front of him. I'd been so nervous that I'd dropped some of his lunch down his lap and was now trying in vain to mop it up so that a good patch of his trousers was sopping wet. Will hadn't said anything, except to tell me to please stop apologizing, but it hadn't helped my general sense of jitteriness.
Why?
No reason. I didn't want him to know how fearful I felt. I'd spent much of that morning, time I usually spent cleaning, reading and rereading the instruction manual for the chairlift. but I was still dreading the moment when I was solely responsible for lifting him 2 feet into the air.
Come on, Clark, what's the problem?
Okay, I just thought it would be easier the first time if there was someone else there who knew the ropes.
As opposed to me, he said.
That's not what I meant.
Because I can't possibly be expected to know anything about my own care.
Do you operate the chairlift? I said boldly. You can tell me exactly what to do, can you? He watched me, his gaze level. If he had been spoiling for a fight, he appeared to change his mind.
Fair point. Yes, he's coming. He's a useful extra pair of hands. Plus, I thought you'd work yourself into less of a state if you had him there.
I'm not in a state, I protested.
Evidently.
He glanced down at his lap, which I was still mopping with a cloth. I had got the pasta sauce off, but he was soaked.
So, am I going as an incontinent?
I'm not finished. I plugged in the hairdryer and directed the nozzle towards his crutch. As the hot air blasted onto his trousers, he raised his eyebrows. Yes, well, I said. It's not exactly what I expected to be doing on a Friday afternoon, either.
You really are tense, aren't you?
I could feel him studying me.
Oh, lighten up, Clark. I'm the one having scalding hot air directed at my genitals.
I didn't respond. I heard his voice over the roar of the hairdryer.
Come on, what's the worst that could happen? I end up in a wheelchair?
It may sound stupid, but I couldn't help but laugh. It was the closest Will had come to actually trying to make me feel better. The car looked like a normal people carrier from the outside, but when the rear passenger door was unlocked, a ramp descended from the side and lowered to the ground. With Nathan looking on, I guided Will's outside chair, he had a separate one for travelling, squarely onto the ramp, checked the electrical lockdown brake, and programmed it to slowly lift him up into the car. Nathan slid into the other passenger seat, belted him and secured the wheels. Trying to stop my hands from trembling, I got into the driver's seat, released the handbrake, and drove slowly down the drive toward the hospital. Away from home, Will appeared to shrink a little. It was chilly outside, and Nathan and I had bundled him up into his scarf and thick coat, but still he grew quieter, his jaw set, somehow diminished by the greater space of his surroundings. Every time I looked into my rear-view mirror, which was often, I was terrified even with Nathan there that somehow the chair would break loose from its moorings. He was gazing out the window, his expression impenetrable. Even when I stalled or braked too hard, which I did several times, he just winced a little and waited while I sorted myself out. By the time we reached the hospital, I'd actually broken out in a fine sweat. I drove around the hospital car park 3 times, too afraid to reverse into any but the largest of spaces, until I could sense that the 2 men were beginning to lose patience. Then, finally, I lowered the ramp, and Nathan helped roll Will's chair out onto the tarmac.
"Good job,"
Nathan said, clapping me on the back as he let himself out. But I found it hard to believe it had been. There are things you don't notice until you accompany someone with a wheelchair.
One is how rubbish most pavements are, pockmarked with badly patched holes, or just plain uneven. Walking slowly next to Will as he wheeled himself along, I saw how every uneven slab caused him to jolt painfully, or how often he had to steer carefully around some potential obstacle. Nathan pretended not to notice, but I saw him watching too. Will just looked grim-faced and resolute.
The other thing is how inconsiderate most drivers are.
They park up against the sloped cutouts on the sidewalks, or so close together that there's no way for a wheelchair to actually cross the road. I was shocked, and a couple of times even tempted to leave some rude note tucked into a windscreen wiper, but Nathan and Will seemed used to it. Nathan pointed out a suitable crossing place, and each of us flanking Will, we finally crossed. Will hadn't said a single word since leaving the house. The hospital itself was a gleaming low-rise building, the immaculate reception area more like that of some modernistic hotel, perhaps testament to private insurance. I held back as Will told the receptionist his name, and then followed him and Nathan down a long corridor. Nathan was carrying a huge backpack that contained anything that Will might be likely to need during his short visit, from beakers to spare clothes. He'd packed it in front of me that morning, detailing every possible eventuality.
"I guess it's a good thing we don't have to do this too often," he had said, catching my appalled expression.
I didn't follow Will into the appointment. Nathan and I sat on the comfortable chairs outside the consultant's room. There was no hospital smell, and there were fresh flowers in a vase on the windowsill. Not just any old flowers, either. Huge, exotic things that I didn't know the names of, artfully arranged in minimalist clumps. "What are they doing in there?" I said, after we'd been there half an hour. Nathan looked up from his book.
"It's just a 6-month checkup."
"What, to see if he's getting any better?" Nathan put his book down.
"He's not getting any better. It's a spinal cord injury."
"But you do physio and stuff with him."
"That's to try and keep his physical condition up. To stop him atrophying and his bones demineralizing, his legs pooling, that kind of thing."
When he spoke again, his voice was gentle, as if he thought he might disappoint me.
"He's not going to walk again, Louisa. That only happens in Hollywood movies. All we're doing is trying to keep him out of pain and keep up whatever range of movement he has."
"Does he do this stuff for you? The physio stuff? He doesn't seem to want to do anything that I suggest." Nathan wrinkled his nose.
"He does it, but I don't think his heart's in it. When I first came, he was determined. He'd come pretty far in rehab. But after a year with no improvement, I think he found it tough to keep believing it was worth it."
"Do you think he should keep trying?" Nathan stared at the floor.
"Honestly? He's a C5-6 quadriplegic. That means nothing works below about here."
He placed a hand on the upper part of his chest.
"They haven't worked out how to fix the spinal cord yet."
I stared at the door, thinking about Will's face as we drove along in the winter sunshine, the beaming face of the man on the skiing holiday. "There are all sorts of medical advances taking place, though, right? I mean, somewhere like this. They must be working on stuff all the time."
"That's a pretty good hospital," he said evenly.
"Where there's life and all that?" Nathan looked at me, then back at his book.
"Sure,"
he said. I went to get a coffee at 3:15, on Nathan's say-so. He said these appointments could go on for some time, and that he would hold the fort until I got back. I dawdled a little in the reception area, flicking through the magazines and the newsagents, lingering over chocolate bars. Perhaps predictably, I got lost trying to find my way back to the corridor and had to ask several nurses where I should go, two of whom didn't even know. When I got there, the coffee cooling in my hand, the corridor was empty. As I drew closer, I could see that the consultant's door was ajar. I hesitated outside,
But I could hear Mrs. Traynor's voice in my ears all the time now, criticizing me for leaving him. I'd done it again.
"So we'll see you in 3 months' time, Mr. Traynor," a voice was saying. "I've adjusted those antispasm meds, and I'll make sure someone calls you with the results of the tests. Probably Monday."
I heard Will's voice.
"Can I get these from the pharmacy downstairs?" "Yes. Here. They should be able to give you some more of those, too."
A woman's voice. "Shall I take that folder?" I realized they must have been about to leave. I knocked, and someone called for me to come in. Two sets of eyes swiveled toward me.
"I'm sorry," said the consultant, rising from his chair. "I thought you were the physio."
"I'm Will's helper," I said, hanging onto the door. Will was braced forward in his chair as Nathan pulled down his shirt. "Sorry, I thought you were done."
"Just give us a minute, will you, Louisa?"
Will's voice cut into the room. Muttering my apologies, I backed out, my face burning. It wasn't the sight of Will's uncovered body that had shocked me, slim and scarred as it was. It wasn't the vaguely irritated look of the consultant, the same sort of look that Mrs. Traynor gave me day after day, a look that made me realize I was still the same blundering idiot, even if I did earn a higher hourly rate. No. It was the livid red lines scoring Will's wrists, the long, jagged scars that couldn't be disguised, no matter how swiftly Nathan pulled down Will's sleeves. Chapter 6. The snow came so suddenly that I left home under a bright blue sky, and not half an hour later I was headed past a castle that looked like a cake decoration, surrounded by a layer of thick white icing. I trudged up the drive, my footsteps muffled and my toes already numb, shivering under my too thin Chinese silk coat. A whirl of thick white flakes emerged from an iron-gray infinity, almost obscuring Granter House, blotting out sound and slowing the world to an unnatural pace. Beyond the neatly trimmed hedge, cars drove past with a newfound caution. Pedestrians slipped and squealed on the sidewalks. I pulled my scarf up over my nose and wished I'd worn something more suitable than ballet pumps and a velvet mini-dress. To my surprise, it wasn't Nathan who opened the door, but Will's father.
"He's in bed," he said,
glancing up at the sky from the doorway.
"He's not too good. I was just wondering whether to call the doctor."
"Where's Nathan?"
"Morning off. Of course it would be today. Bloody agency nurse came and went in 6 seconds flat. If this snow keeps on, I'm not sure what we'll do later."
He shrugged, as if these things couldn't be helped, and disappeared back down the corridor, apparently relieved that he no longer had to be responsible.
"You know what he needs, yes?"
he called over his shoulder. I took off my coat and shoes, and as I knew Mrs. Traynor was in court, she marked her dates on a diary in Will's kitchen, put my wet socks over a radiator to dry. A pair of Will's were in the clean washing basket, so I put them on. They looked comically large on me, but it was heaven to have warm, dry feet. Will didn't respond when I called out, so after a while I made him a drink, knocked quietly, and poked my head around the door. In the dim light I could just make out the shape under the duvet. He was fast asleep. I took a step backward, closed the door behind me, and began working my way through the morning's tasks. My mother seemed to glean an almost physical satisfaction from a well-ordered house. I'd been vacuuming and cleaning daily for a month now, and I still couldn't see the attraction. I suspected there would never be a point in my life when I wouldn't prefer somebody else to do it. But on a day like today, when Will was confined to bed and the world seemed to have stilled outside, I could also see there was a kind of meditative pleasure in working my way from one end of the annex to the other. While I dusted and polished, I took the radio from room to room with me, keeping the volume low so that I didn't disturb Will. Periodically I put my head around the door just to see that he was breathing, and it was only when it got to 1 o'clock and he still hadn't woken up that I started to feel a little anxious. I filled the log basket, noting that several inches of snow had now settled. I made Will a fresh drink and then knocked. When I knocked again, I did so loudly.
Yes?
His voice was hoarse, as if I'd woken him.
It's me.
When he didn't respond, I said, Louisa, am I okay to come in?
I'm hardly doing the Dance of the Seven Veils.
The room was shadowed, the curtains still drawn. I walked in, letting my eyes adjust to the light. Will was on one side, one arm bent in front of him as if to prop himself up, as he had been before when I looked in. Sometimes it was easy to forget he wouldn't be able to turn over by himself. His hair stuck up on one side, and a duvet was tucked neatly around him. The smell of warm, unwashed male filled the room. Not unpleasant, but still a little startling as part of a working day.
What can I do? Do you want your drink?
I need to change position.
I put the drink down on a chest of drawers and walked over to the bed.
What do you want me to do?
He swallowed carefully, as if it were painful.
Lift and turn me, then raise the back of the bed. Here.
He nodded for me to come closer.
Put your arms under mine. Link your hands behind my back, and then pull back. Keep your backside on the bed, and that way you shouldn't strain your lower back.
I couldn't pretend this wasn't a bit weird. I reached around him, the scent of him filling my nostrils, his skin warm against mine. I couldn't have been in any closer unless I'd begun nibbling on his ear. The thought made me mildly hysterical, and I struggled to keep myself together.
What?
Nothing.
I took a breath, linked my hands, and adjusted my position until I felt I had him securely. He was broader than I'd expected, somehow heavier. And then, on a count of three, I pulled back.
Jesus, he exclaimed into my shoulder.
What?
I nearly dropped him.
Your hands are bloody freezing.
Yes. Well, if you bothered to get out of bed, you'd know that it's actually snowing outside.
I was half joking, but now I realized his skin was hot under his t-shirt, an intense heat that seemed to come from deep within him. He groaned slightly as I adjusted him against the pillow, and I tried to make my movements as slow and gentle as possible. He pointed out the remote control device that would bring his head and shoulders up.
Not too much, though, he murmured. A bit dizzy.
I turned on the bedside light, ignoring his vague protest, so that I could see his face.
Will, are you okay?
I had to say it twice before he answered me.
Not my best day.
Do you need painkillers?
Yes, strong ones.
Maybe some paracetamol?
He lay back against the cool pillow with a sigh. I gave him the beaker, watched him swallow.
Thank you, he said afterward.
And I felt suddenly uneasy. Will never thanked me for anything. He closed his eyes, and for a while I just stood in the doorway and watched him, his chest rising and falling under his t-shirt, his mouth slightly open. His breathing was shallow, and perhaps a little more laboured than on other days. But I'd never seen him out of his chair, and I wasn't sure whether it was something to do with the pressure of lying down.
"Go," he muttered.